This is a piece I wrote. Actually, the first time I ever did it, a spoken word piece for the Bee in the Room contest to win Alexander Hamilton tickets. Solo was one of the judges. It's called A Manifesto from the Middle. A Manifesto from the Middle. Protest, pass the test. Activist, act the gist. All who march, don't march in streets. Don't tell me I'm lukewarm. I burn bright with love, unwilling to throw out the zealot or the sellout. All who march, don't march in streets. A manifesto, not the manifesto. I refuse to subtract or delete, but act on the best of plans from the West and fans of the East, choosing not to hide from the other side. All who march don't march in streets. Our culture creates a chasm of shame. The polls are busy tweeting all the fame, while the middle quietly builds bridges, creating art between the head, the hand, and the heart. The middle who care are the core or the organs, vital to life, heart and lungs, blood beating, breath breathing, finding food that feeds the feet, helps the hands, heals the weak. All who march don't march in streets. I'm not lukewarm. I burn hot with a fierce love for all kinds of people, left, right, and middle. The ones I like, dislike, even the ones who fight with animosity towards diversity and me. All who march don't march in streets. But I must admit, the king does get under my skin. Makes me wary of whether my manifesto isn't just a no-show, isn't bringing others low, not because of intent, but because I represent the power of privilege, not the streets. An insider with white benefits, able to pass on left or right, whatever side I might walk on the street. A letter from Birmingham does sometimes slam my manifesto. Whoa. Maybe I should walk, march in streets. But justice doesn't just happen in the streets. And if all who march, march in the streets, who will connect the street and the feet off the concrete? All who march, don't march in streets. A manifesto from the middle, not the manifesto. Just saying, so you know. Thank you.
Patiently waiting, I'm passionately smashing every expectation, every action's an act of creation. I'm laughing in the face of casualties and sorrow. The first time I'm thinking past tomorrow.
All right, so I wasn't throwing away my shot to try to win tickets to Hamilton. If you were sitting in the back, you heard laughter up here, and the laughter was about Solo saying that it wasn't because of him that I didn't win the tickets. Although the guy who won was absolutely amazing and totally deserved it, and he was actually performed that piece last Monday night at church in a pub. So sometimes we can make things happen on one night that we can't make happen on Sunday morning. So if you didn't make it, you missed it. Because he was absolutely amazing. You guys picked well. So thank you for picking him. In the midst of that, taking a shot, I found myself when I first saw that contest thinking, man, should I like try to put together a spoken word piece? I knew I wasn't going to rap. It was either you could either rap or you could do spoken word. And I was like, should I like try to do something? Should I work on it? Or should I wait until the workshop that they were hosting where they brought in an MC and a poet to help you? Should I work or should I wait? Should I work or should I wait? When working and waiting meet in a duel, who wins? So that's the problem I want to wrestle with this morning. When do you work and when do you wait? like Solo's piece that he just did, sometimes you feel like in a maze. You can't find your way out. You're stuck. You go down this and you find yourself at a dead end of working. You go down this way and you find yourself at a dead end of waiting. When do you work? When do you wait? When do you work? And when do you wait? This series is called God in Hamilton. It's based on a book by the same name. And that is based on the musical Hamilton, of course, which is at the Wharton these several weeks. Many of you have told me that you've gone and been excited to go. But if you don't have the hundreds of dollars to plop down tickets, you can just listen to all of it free online like I've done. The musical is about Alexander Hamilton, one of the founding fathers of the United States. And if you know anything about Hamilton, he had a revolutionary Protestant work ethic. The guy was nonstop. He got all kinds of stuff done. Ron Chernow, who wrote a historical biography of Hamilton that the musical was based on, said this: if Washington, that's George Washington, was the father of the country, then Alexander Hamilton was surely the father of the American government. Listen to these are just some of the things that he did. He was on George Washington's wartime staff. He led soldiers at Yorktown. He attended the Constitutional Convention. He wrote 51 Federalist Papers. He was the first Secretary of the Treasury, which meant he created our banking and financial system. He dealt with the overwhelming national debt from the Revolution. He created tax protocol and customs regulations. He established the U.S. Postal Service, and he created the U.S. Coast Guard. The guy was nonstop. And that's one of the songs in the musical is Nonstop. I want to play a little piece of that for you to see or hear kind of how that plays out. At the very end of it, he's talking with George Washington as Washington is asking him to be part of his group that's leading this war, the Revolutionary War. Here it is, Nonstop.
Alexander joins forces with James Madison and John Jay to write a series of essays defending the new United States Constitution entitled The Federalist Papers. The plan was to write a total of 25 essays, the work divided evenly among the three men. In the end, they wrote 85 essays in the span of 6 months. John Jay got sick after writing 5. James Madison wrote 29. Hamilton wrote the other 51. How do you write like you're running out of time? Write day and night like you're running out of time. Every day you fight like you're running out of time. Like you're running out of time. Are you running out of time? How do you write like tomorrow won't arrive? How do you write like you needed to survive? How do you write every second you're alive? Every second you're alive. Every second you're alive.
They're asking me to lead. I'm doing the best I can to get the people that I need. I'm asking you to be my right hand man.
Or state.
I know it's a lot to
treasury
ask
or state.
To leave behind the world you know.
Sir, do you want me to run the Treasury or State Department?
Treasury.
Let's go.
So that song continues, and the activity, the nonstop nature of Hamilton's life, his revolutionary Protestant work ethic, takes a toll on him and the relationships around him, particularly his wife Eliza. And the song ends with an argument between Eliza and Hamilton, and then it sort of bursts into an argument with everybody. Listen to it.
Alexander.
I have to leave.
Alexander.
Look around at how lucky we are to be alive right now.
Helpless.
They are asking me to leave.
Look around.
So who won, Eliza or his shot? He chose the shot, right? When do you work? When do you wait? What's the cost of both? It's a maze. Now, opposite Hamilton in the musical and in history is Aaron Burr. Aaron Burr is the third vice president of the United States. And Burr and Hamilton were enemies at times. In fact, Burr was the one who eventually shot Hamilton. Burr was a sitting vice president. He's the third vice president of the United States with Thomas Jefferson, and he goes and he shoots the previous Secretary of Treasury. Now, politics is pretty bad right now, isn't it? But last I checked, Mike Pence has yet to shoot Joe Biden. It might happen yet, but it's not that bad yet, okay? This is how bad it was. And this is so unusual because Burr is known for kind of waiting for it, for inactivity, for not causing waves. In fact, his theme song is called Wait For It. Here it is.
Wait for it.
I am the one thing in life I can control.
Wait for it.
I am inimitable, I am an original.
Wait for it.
I'm not falling behind or running late.
Wait for it.
I'm not standing still, I am lying in wait.
Wait.
Hamilton faces an endless uphill climb.
Climb.
He has something to prove, he has nothing to
lose.
Hamilton faces relentless, he wastes no time.
Time.
What is it like in his shoes?
Life doesn't discriminate between the sinners and the saints. It takes, and we give it in anyway. We rise and we fall and we break and we make our mistakes. And if there's a reason I'm still alive and so many have died, then I'm willing to
when are you like Hamilton and you go into action mode and you work? When are you like Burr and you wait for it? That's the problem I want to wrestle with. I think probably each of us has been in a situation where we're not sure, do I keep moving forward or do I hang back? So let's turn to the Bible. Let's see if it gives us any direction. I think there's a story that's going to help us. It's one of the stories of Israel coming out of slavery in Egypt. They've been for decades, for several generations, slaves in Egypt. Moses leads them out. They get out into the desert. Pharaoh realizes he thinks he's made a mistake, so he goes running after them with his whole army. They find themselves backed up against the Red Sea. So on one side, they've got Pharaoh, probably the strongest army on the face of the earth at that point, with all of his chariots and horses and armor and soldiers and infantry and everything else they had. And on the other side is a huge body of water. What do they do? Do they fight? Do they work? Or do they just stand around and die? Or let God do something? Well, let's see. Here's how the story goes. As Pharaoh approached, the people of Israel looked up and panicked when they saw the Egyptians overtaking them. I think any of us would be panicked. And maybe when you're in that situation of working or waiting, you're panicked too. They cried out to the Lord and they said to Moses, "Why did you bring us out here to die in the wilderness? Weren't there enough graves for us in Egypt? What have you done to us? Why did you make us leave Egypt?" They go so far as to say, "Didn't we tell you this would happen while we were still in Egypt? We said, 'Leave us alone. Let us be slaves to the Egyptians. It's better to be a slave in Egypt than a corpse in the wilderness.'" This is a lesson for any of you who are in leadership, is that there is always a go back to Egypt committee that would prefer slavery of the past to the freedom and uncertainty of the future. Don't be on the go back to Egypt committee, okay? Don't give into it. Don't do that kind of work and waiting. So here's what Moses responds to him. He says, "Don't be afraid. Just stand still and watch." What's that? Work or wait? Wait for it. Wait for it. The Lord will rescue you today. The Egyptians you see today will never be seen again. The Lord himself will fight for you. Just carry on and stay calm. Wait for it. Wait for it. Wait for it. Do you work or do you wait? So in the midst of Moses telling the people this, the Lord speaks to Moses and says, "Why are you crying out to me? Tell the people to get moving." What's that? Wait or work. I'm not going to miss my shot. Do you work or do you wait? Do you work or do you wait? That's the problem. Do you work or do you wait? If you walk away with anything today, here's the one thing I want you to walk away with, okay? This is the point of today's message. We wait in the work with God. We do both at the same time. We wait and we work, just like the Israelites in the desert. They waited for God, and then they started marching forward. We wait in the work with God. We listen and labor. We stop and start. We rest and react. We attend and act. We tarry and transact. We percolate and push. We pause and perform. We pray and proceed. We wait in the work with God. John Wesley, the founder of the Methodist movement, he was a contemporary of all of the revolutionaries during the 18th century, 1700s. He wrote a commentary on the whole Bible, and this is what he said about this particular passage. He said, "This was the salvation of God, which they stood still to see, wait, by marching forward with all their might." Work. Wait and work at the same time with God. Now, you read that and you're like, that doesn't even make sense, right? That seems impossible. But like the band sang earlier, we worship a God who does the impossible things. That you wait and you work simultaneously. Paul, the first missionary of the church and the author of many of the books of the Bible, the guy was like the Alexander Hamilton of Bible times. I mean, if there's somebody who worked hard, it was Paul. And Paul wrote a letter to the church at Corinth, and he said this, "But whatever I am now, it's all because God poured his special favor on me and not without results." So God was doing the work here. "For I have worked harder than any of the other apostles." Harder than Thomas Jefferson, harder than John Adams, harder than James Madison, harder than any of the others. "Yet it was not I, but God who was working through me by his grace." You wait in the work with God. Christians have a way of talking about this. It's kind of a funny phrase. They call it means of grace. And here's my definition of the means of grace. The means of grace are where we take action by putting ourselves, we wait in a place where God promised to show up. A means of grace is prayer. Prayer is action. You have to do something to pray. You put yourself in prayer in a place where God said God would show up. A means of grace is worship. You all are here. It's Memorial Day weekend. It's you could be somewhere else. If you were somewhere else, I hope all those people at Sycamore Creek are going to church this morning, right? I bet they are when they're up north. But it takes work to get into worship to wait for God. Art creativity takes work, but God created us in God's image, and God is a creator God, and when we create art, we are working the image of God through us, waiting to see what God will do in us and through us through our art. We take action by waiting in a place where God promised to show up. When we come to this communion table, when we do that, we usually offer communion once a month. When you come up here, you are putting yourself in a place where God said that God would show up. It is the prayer, the fasting, the worship, the Bible study, Those are means by which we receive God's grace, which transforms us and those around us. We wait in the work with God. Now, as a pastor, I've had a front row seat to a lot of people's lives. And what I've noticed at times is that in one of those, if you put work and wait on a scale, there are times where we need to emphasize the waiting, but not neglect the working. And there's other times where we need to emphasize the waiting, but not neglect, emphasize the working, but not neglect the waiting, okay? That there tends to be kind of a dual emphasis here, but one of them tends to take a primary place. And so I want to walk through some places where I see us, where maybe we should wait a little more than work, and some places where maybe we should work a little more than wait, but not neglect the other, okay? So let's start with when you should wait while working. And here's the first one. In our culture, we are really quick to make action on spending money. I mean, it just flies out of our pockets. In fact, it flies out so fast now that my phone has the ability to pay, and I just magically wave it, across the machine, and somehow in the black box of whatever happens, like, money comes out of my account. But if you've got a credit card set up on that, and you're doing that, and that's a quick way to add up debt, right? We are very quick to spend money. Now, in our culture, maybe we should just take a little pause before we spend money. We're gonna emphasize waiting on spending money. We're gonna wait by making sure that it's in our budget. Maybe even praying, does this bring glory to God in the way that I'm going to spend money? Does it love other people? Is it just way to spend money? Is it a just way to spend money? Now, those are all the things that you're acting, right? Like, it's not like you don't act. If you're going to wait, then you had to do the work of doing a budget. You had to do the work of praying about it. But maybe we should emphasize waiting a little bit more when it comes to spending money. In your program, your notes for today's message, I put a resource for each one of these. So, for example, this one on money is goodsensemovement.org. If you find yourself struggling, you need to sort of have some tools to wait a little more, check out that website, goodsensemovement.org. All right, here's another one. When it comes to goals and plans, I see a lot of people who have goals with no clear plan about how to get to that goal. You want to start a business, but I have seen you do nothing to develop the skill set required to start your own business. One of the really cool things that's happening right after this service is that at the last time that we invited people to express interest in serving or volunteering in the church, we had more people than I've ever had express interest in preaching or becoming a pastor, like 12 people. And so I had to figure out how do you mentor 12 people of preaching and being a pastor? I've always just done it one-on-one. It's a good problem to have, right? God's working here at Sycamore Creek, raising people up. So they're meeting after this service for about 2.5 hours to begin some mentoring about that, the first of several meetings. But if you want to ultimately become a pastor in a United Methodist church in the role that I'm playing, there's a lot of steps between the goal and where you're at right now. And one of those includes seminary, which all of those who are attending this meeting aren't necessarily going to go that route. But at seminary, one of the ways that I had to wait was I'm a foodie. I love eating good food. But I ate more peanut butter and jelly sandwiches for those 4 years than I have ever in the rest of my life. Because you have to work a plan. You have to wait for it. You don't just get to like a master's degree by not having a plan that gets you there. So the waiting is creating the plan. And that's action, right? So you're waiting for the goal. Meanwhile, you're also praying, God, give me the perseverance to persevere through the endurance to persevere through the plan to get to the goal. When you should wait before maybe you should act. Another one is commitments. when you say yes to things. Will you do this? Yes. Will you do that? Yes. Will you do this? Yes. And one of the things that I notice is people don't often take into account, if you say yes to something, what else do you have to say? You have to say no to something else. I mean, even if you're like a slug that just sits around and watch TV all day, you know, you still have to say no to watching TV and you to say yes to something else. And so maybe you should just wait a little bit before you make a commitment to say yes. Now, when I'm really asking somebody to do something significant, I tell them, listen, I don't want you to say yes or no right now. I'm going to give you a week or two. Go home. Talk to the people of wisdom that you make decisions with. That's part of the waiting, right? Like there's this acting here while there's waiting. I want you to pray about it. And in a week or two, I'm going to call you back and see whether you are ready to make this commitment or not. Maybe we should just wait a little bit before we make a commitment. Even if your pastor's asking you to do something, I would rather it be something God wants you to do than that you just say yes without figuring out how you're going to have time to do it. All right? Commitments. Here's another one. Sex. In our culture, we are so quick to ramp up that bodily connection. It's a bond, right? When you have sex, you create a bond between you and another person. And the Christian ethic of sex is that bond is carried, the weight of that bond is carried by the equal weight of a commitment for a lifetime. That's marriage. So maybe we should just wait a little bit until the relationship has that level of commitment to carry the weight of that closeness of a bond. Now, that doesn't mean you're not doing anything while you're waiting for that, okay? I'm not telling you don't hold hands. I'm not telling you don't kiss. I'm not telling you, like, you're building the relationship. You're building the bonds up to that place. You're asking your friends and your close spiritual friends, your close fellow followers of Jesus, is this someone I should get married to? Is this a commitment I should make? We're going to emphasize the waiting when it comes to sex, but there's still acting that we do. Still acting. All right, here's one last one. Divorce. I think we're really quick in our culture to jump right to divorce. And I'm not saying that should never happen. But there's a lot of steps before you get there that you can take that's part of the waiting. One of them is just seeing a counselor together. In fact, we have a counselor here at Sycamore Creek. Her name's Damaris Garcia. She speaks English and Spanish. She can counsel in both of those. And we have funds available. If you can't afford a counselor, then we have funds to help you do that. But that's a first step. You're waiting divorce, so you act. You go see a counselor. And then maybe another step is separating from rooms. And maybe another step is an out-of-house separation. I had some friends who, they separated out of their house, and I thought, oh, this is over. It's never getting back together. But when they didn't live together, they both missed each other enough. Like, they realized that the challenges they were having was not worth being apart from each other, what they still had together. And they ended up getting back together. There was some counseling was involved and so on. But you see, that maybe we should just wait a bit for divorce. But that doesn't mean there's not work that we're doing in the midst of it. All right. So let's turn to the other side, when you should work or emphasize work in the midst of waiting. And Kevin Cloud, the author of God in Hamilton, who was here preaching with us last week, he talks about in his book this struggle of taking being as active as Hamilton. And here's what he says. He says, too often in my spiritual life, I lack initiative. I lack working. He likes waiting is what he's saying. My fear and lack of faith in both God and myself immobilizes me from attempting bold risks, those Hamilton-esque, like, you know, revolutionary Protestant work ethic, creativity. At times, I see initiative as undermining the grace of God as a lack of faith in God's activity and providence. So let's talk about when you should work, but you're also waiting. One of them is time with God. If you wait for the perfect time to spend with God, when your kids are quiet and in bed, or they're at some friend's house, or when you like have gone to Art Van and bought the perfect like spiritual chair to pray in, or like, you know, when after you've had a really great day and all of the stars have aligned and it's, you know, then it's time to spend time with God. Guess what's going to happen? You're never going to spend time with God. You need to act. You need to do it today. Actually, I'm preaching to the choir. You are doing it today. You're here on a holiday weekend in worship, spending time with God. Now, I brought with me a Bible that I've used in the past. It's the NRSV Daily Bible. Several of you have told me that in the past when I've mentioned this that you bought this as well and used it. It's a Bible that's split into 365 readings. So you're supposed to read it in a year. And I found myself, when I was reading through this and starting, you know, I had great plans, of course, at the beginning that I was going to do this every single day. But then I would get to like day 42 in the book of Numbers. And I was like, I'd get busy and I wouldn't do it. And then there was this temptation, well, I missed 4 or 5 days, so I'm just going to toss it and not spend time with God reading the Bible. But somehow I persevered through it. You know how long it took me to do 365 readings? It took me 2 years. Your pastor is a failure at the one-year Bible. But what's better, to read a Bible in 2 years or to read it in no years? Like, you know, to read it in 2 years. Now, this Bible's just been sitting on my shelf at home collecting dust. Somebody, God's speaking to you right now, and you need this Bible. It's yours today, okay? In fact, you don't even have to come to me. It's just going to be sitting here. You come pick it up. I don't need it anymore. I've got lots of other Bibles, okay? It's yours. Somebody needs to act today to spend time with God. Here's another one, creativity. We think that we're not good enough, we're not creative enough, we're not cool enough, we're not smart enough, we're not whatever. I'll tell you what, Solo was one of the judges in that contest with 4 other judges, and they all like oozed coolness. In fact, next week we have one of the judges here. His name's Masaki, and he oozes coolness. And I got up there, and I just felt so small, very uncool, very white. If I had waited till I was cool enough, I wouldn't have done that, would I? Like. Now, I didn't win the tickets, but I had a blast doing it. I met awesome people like Solo, who I already knew, but I met Masaki, who I didn't know, and Noor, who I didn't know. And you know, there were amazing things that happened in creativity. Too often, we wait for everything to be perfect, to be creative, but don't wait. Tomorrow's the perfect day. You got the day off work. Go make something tomorrow. Be like God, who created and made you in his image as a creator, too. Participate in the creative redemption of our world. All right, here's another one. I said commitments was something that we jumped in too quick, but I think it could go the other way as well. Something that sociologists have noticed about millennials, the generation that's coming up, actually the millennials are getting old. There's another generation now. We're going to start talking about them, and then millennials will be like Gen Xers, which we never talk about, like me. So Gen Z, yeah, they've got some different names. But one of the struggles that millennials and the generations below that are having right now is making commitments. And the reason they're having a trouble making commitments, there's a lot of reasons, but one of them is that there are more options for millennials than there ever have been. For example, research has been shown that if you take like 50 varieties of jam and put them on a table in a grocery store, you will sell less jam than if you put a table with 3 kinds of jam on it. The fewer the choices, the easier the decision making. The more choices, the more anxiety in the decision making, and more fear of missing out of all of the other 49 jams that you didn't choose. 49 choices to be wrong. Before is just 2. You know, that's a pretty good chance of getting the right one just by blind luck, 33%. that you're going to pick the right jam. So commitment, you know, don't wait till everything is right. Make a commitment. A commitment doesn't have to be a lifetime. It can be a season. In fact, a great way to make a commitment today is to sign up for a small group. In your program today are all of our small groups. They're not forever. You're not in a small group at Sycamore Creek till Jesus comes back. You are just in a small group for a semester. And if you don't like the people in your small group and you don't like the leader, you're done after a semester. But you may come to find out that, like me, when I was ended up with a roommate in college who was a farm boy from Wisconsin and I was an urban city dweller from Indianapolis, and I thought, "What? How in the world will I like this guy? And what will we talk about? And how am I going to sit through Rush Limbaugh on the TV every night and talk about guns and hunting and all these things that I was totally foreign to?" Turns out that he was an awesome friend and a lifelong friend. You might find that if you make a commitment to a small group, that you make a lifelong friend this summer. Make a commitment. Make a commitment. Here's another place where we tend to wait a little too much and we should act, and that's if we find ourselves in an abusive relationship. On average... my wife is telling me to preach up here, so... apparently she's got something to say to me after the service. On average, it takes a woman in an abusive relationship 7 times of leaving before she finally leaves. 7 times. It's hard to do. It is hard to do. It's not always just men abusing women. It does go the other way. And some that creates even more challenge because the man feels like even an extra social stigma that the woman was beating up on him. John Wesley, the founder of Methodism, ended up in an abusive marriage. His wife was she was verbally abusive and likely physically abusive. It was unheard of at the time that a Church of England priest would get a divorce, and so he just moved out. He became so distant from her that he heard about her death in the newspaper. If you're waiting for your abusive spouse or boyfriend or girlfriend to stop being abusive, I want to tell you today to act. Get out. Get safe. In your program, there's contact information for EVE here locally. It's Ending Violent Encounters, EVE. Use that as a resource. Act today. Get out. Make this the 7th time. Do it. Here's one last thing. Injustice. When we see injustice, we like are waiting for just the right time, just the right circumstances, you know, to have a big chunk of time in our calendar to be able to devote to it, to have, you know, just the right courage to say something rather than to remain silent. I wrestle with this in my social media presence. If you follow me on Facebook or Instagram or something, you'll see like I basically post really safe stuff. I post stuff about my kids and I post stuff about the church. Those are two pretty safe things, for the most part. But as I've gotten involved in racial reconciliation, some of my friends, like Pastor Sean Holland, have said to me, we want, say something. Say something. Anything. So I was wrestling with this. Sarah and I were talking about it when we were on vacation a couple weeks ago, and she said to me, you know what, really what you should do is, instead of you trying to figure out what to say, why don't you just share the post that Pastor Sean shares? Like, sit under the leadership of a black pastor for a while and then just amplify his voice. You don't need another voice in this. Like, use your platform to amplify his. Like, that sounds like a good idea. I said that, and I was thinking, when was the last time I saw Pastor Sean post something, like, kind of controversial? And, you know, like, he doesn't do it very often. So I thought I was getting into something, you know, this wasn't going to cause me too much of a challenge. He maybe does it like once every other month, like shares something. He shares a lot of other things, ministry-wise. He's worth checking out. But that day after that, I made that commitment, the week after, Sean posted 4 things. 4 things. I had to read more, like, on sort of issues of justice. I had to read all the articles, watch the videos. Like, and they're not easy to watch. Like, they're painful. And then at the end of the week, I called him up and I said, hey, I didn't know if you noticed I was doing this. And we ended up having a 2.5 hour conversation on the phone till midnight about the whole thing. And, but it was taking action on injustice. I mean, injustice takes more than just sharing stuff on social media, but you know what I mean. I'm going to invite Solo Brooks to come back up. He has a spoken word piece that's about taking action in the face of injustice locally right here in Michigan. And I'll let him tell you about it and then perform it.
Hello again. As he said, the name of the poem is After the Factory. I'm originally from the West Coast. I was born and raised in Long Beach, California. I moved to downtown Los Angeles, lived the majority of my life there, and then met my wife in Portland, Oregon. Now I'm in Michigan. but I moved here in 2009, right in the height of everything falling apart. And I didn't understand the grasp that GM had on Michigan. Coming from California, there's so many other options to make a bunch of money, you know, and seeing how GM was basically God as far as when it came to work and provision. I worked at a place and I interviewed a man. He was probably late 40s, early 50s, and he started crying in the interview. And I gave him a second, and he explained to me that he was 6th generation of his family to work for GM. So that's all he knew. It was get out of school, work for GM. That's all he saw his family do for 6 generations. So when everything folded and fell apart, he was lost. And to hear people say, I haven't worked for a year and a half. And that was very eye-opening for me. And so this piece is based on that. After the factory, what comes next? And throughout my time here, I've seen the Lansing, Detroit, Grant, everyone just rally around each other and rebuild and stand strong on, we're going to make this a great place again. And it's very encouraging, and I've been blessed to be a part of it. So thank you for anybody who has been a part of that rebirth. Here's After the Factory. How many of us have heard God say, I want to send you in my name? How many of us have failed to respond because of ourselves we are ashamed? How many of us have seen a hungry man and failed to lend a helping hand? How many of us have heard God call and failed to say, here I am? These questions are rhetorical. Don't answer, just ponder on why you should help another without being glorified or honored. Be yourself a son or daughter or have one of each of your own. Michigan is part of your responsibility if you call it home. Extremely far from Rome, so don't do as the Romans. Let the enemy in your home inside of a fake Trojan. From me to you, here's something to put your hope in. God's desire, rebuild yours if it's broken. From desire we get want, from want we get more. Through more we get fulfillment, through fulfillment hope's a revolving door that will rotate for the children when they mature. Therefore, take action, my beautiful people. Gather your crew and begin filming the sequel. Action. Sing it loud, put it in effect. Correct the city's posture. No hunched over stance. Stand tall with head high, become the comeback champs. A beautiful song and dance. Motown's alive and kicking. Auto factories fell apart. Cast a new vision. Shove both hands in healthy living. Loosen the earth. Plant a garden and come to find unmeasurable worth. For knowledge, people work. Closing the schools. Do not let this become a living city of fools. Hand the children your tools, hammer, nail, and chisel, so they can hang dreams at eye level and carve out heartfelt riddles. In the middle or outside, wherever you choose to stand, know a small piece of your time can help your fellow woman and man. So take a stand or sit for the same old saying. More talk and less walk won't bring about change. In the veins of revolutionaries, you will find love and passion. that has been poured out to create hope and action. Take action.
There's one more work weight dilemma I want to wrestle with you here and with, and that is sometimes I think that, or I notice that when we are heading away from God and we're wondering, when do we turn back? We feel like we have to get our lives together first before we turn back to God. That we have to work somehow to gain His love so that when we turn back, God will love us. Here's what I want you to know today. You don't have to work to turn back to God. The only work that it is the turn and the receiving of God's grace and love. Don't wait another day to turn back to God. Could I pray for you? Could I pray for us? God, in the midst of the wrestling that we have about whether we should work or whether we should wait, give us wisdom about what to emphasize and help us to wait in the working with you. Give us that wisdom. In the name of Jesus, in the power of the Spirit, and all who agreed said, Amen. Amen.